Good morning, everyone. We're having a slow Friday morning start, but thank you all for coming on another beautiful spring day. We're going to proceed right away with the program as you have it in front of you. We're going to start with a discussion on South Africa, which has a lot of rich material to review. And I think our lead speaker will have some slides to walk us through. And I will turn the floor over to our moderator, Pauline Baker. Thanks.
He was confused by our locations. Good morning. I'm not Pauline Baker. I'm Akwe Amosu. Welcome to the session this morning. Special thanks for getting out here early enough to take part. And it's a real honor for me to share the stage with these two leading thinkers on South Africa and African affairs. Presenting for us this morning is Mweletsi Mbeki, a deputy chairperson of the South African Institute for International Affairs in Johannesburg. He's a leading voice in South Africa, challenging failures and weaknesses in South Africa's foreign policy and on the domestic front too. The author of Architects of Poverty, Why African Capitalism Needs Changing, which was a pretty important intervention in the discussion about what's going wrong in South Africa. And he's the deputy chairperson of the South Africa. He's the deputy chairperson of the South African Institute for International Affairs. Discussing Mweletsi's paper will be Pauline Baker, president of the Fund for Peace, president emeritus of the Fund for Peace. She has taught foreign policy and diplomacy over many years at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University at Johns Hopkins. And before her academic career, worked as a staff director for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And following the pattern yesterday, I'm not going to read both bios in great detail. You've got them there in your notes. We'll kick off with Mweletsi for 10 to 15 minutes. He has a PowerPoint. And then ask Pauline to discuss aspects of his comments. And after that, we should have about half an hour for discussion. Mweletsi.
Thank you very much, Akwe. Well, I first came across this problem, I suppose, what I was told was a problem, which is that there are these emerging democratic countries that are not promoting democracy on the world stage. There was an article in Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. There was an article by a former Mexican foreign minister who raised this issue in his article. And at the time, it's about a year or more ago, at the time I was very curious what this gentleman was on about. Actually, I concluded that the Americans had put him up to it. So I didn't think any further about what he said until I got an invitation from Brookings inviting me to prepare a paper on this subject. So now I was even more convinced that the Americans have got a trick up their sleeve. So that's how I came across the... For me, promotion of democracy by governments on a world stage, I am totally opposed to it. And I will show you how our government... operates in that field. I see democracy promotion by foreign governments as a form of proselytizing, which we in Africa have been huge casualties of proselytizing by Christians and by Muslims. And it's been a cover for all sorts of atrocities against the African populations in the process of apparently converting them to Christians and therefore to be good people, or converting them to Muslims and so on and so forth. So I don't think it is the business of states to proselytize about what other states should be doing. This is one of the reasons why you find people in Africa are quite comfortable, even our governments are quite comfortable with China, because China does business. It does not proselytize about whether you should be a communist, a capitalist, a socialist, or whatever else. They just pay the world price for oil, pay the world price for diamond, for gold, for whatever, and go home, or if they want to invest, they put in their money and do what. So I think for the African people, the proselytizing has a long history and has a very disastrous history. So my own view is that My own view is that the states in international relations should do what states do in international relations, which is to deal with the two hard issues that states are concerned with, which is the security of their country and the security of their populations, and also the economic interests that countries have between themselves. It seems to me that those are the hard aspects of international relations and of relations between states. There are softer aspects of relations between states, which I've tried to put under item 3, but some of them actually may belong to the hard aspects, like intellectual property rights and so on. But essentially, I think they are the hard aspects, which are national security-related aspects and economic aspects, and then the softer cultural exchanges and human rights considerations. Democracy, in my view, is not a terrain for relations between states. As long as we have sovereign states under the current state system that has been around since, I think, the 17th century, democracy is a domestic terrain. As we've argued in our paper, it is a result of a contest between social classes in a given territory for redistribution of political power and resources within that society. So by definition, agents of democracy do not operate in relations between state. Between states, they operate in a given political economy. If you look in any country under the sun, they don't have identical social groups. And even where they have similar social groups, like, say, a capitalist class in South Africa is not the same as one in the United States, or in the United States the same as one in Japan, and so on. So there are many, many forms and manifestations that this takes. So in my view, democracy is not a category of international relations. Democracy is a domestic phenomenon that applies in the domestic arena. Now, we've had, and especially the United States and the United Kingdom have been saying they are promoting democracy in the world. In my view, this has been a cover-up for all sorts of machinations that they have been doing. The Soviet Union used to do the same thing as well. Because who in the United States is going to promote democracy amongst the social groups? How can the United States government promote a contest for redistribution of political power in a particular society? It does not have a social group to do that. What does happen, and what I think is acceptable, is that you have non-state actors like civil society who sympathize with one group or another in a given society. We heard, for example, about how civil society in Turkey supported or opposed the Turkish government's support for al-Bashir in Sudan. We in South Africa, for example, were beneficiaries of civil society in the United States, which pressurized the Congress in particular to pass sanctions against the apartheid system in South Africa. But that is not a state intervention. It was a civil society intervention that brought about, that pressurized the state. So my main objection is states themselves pretending that they can promote democracy in other countries. I think this is really a cover-up for other issues. Now, if I can turn to the foreign policy, specifically of the South African government today. First, in terms of the hard issues of that I address, the South African government does not consider itself to be faced with threats to its security. I was very interested yesterday in the discussions, especially about India and about Turkey, that they are faced with all sorts of threats. They have next door to them, they have nuclear-armed adversaries like India has vis-a-vis Pakistan, Turkey vis-a-vis Israel, or vis-a-vis Iran, which is trying to build up its own nuclear arsenals. In South Africa, we don't have that sort of environment, so our government does not consider itself to be threatened. So we don't have an environment of building up armed response, so to speak. We have had an acquisition of weapons, but this has largely been restricted to the Navy, which I think at the instigation of the United States and NATO leaned on our government to be a first line of defense of the Cape Sea route, which is a very important choke point in terms of world commerce. So South Africa has built up, has bought submarines, corvettes, and related equipment. But I think, as I say, it was made, and a great deal of the training of this Navy is actually undertaken by AFRICOM, which is the Africa Command of the United States. On the land borders, it's the same thing. South Africa, because it does not see itself as having enemies, it hardly patrols the border. I think the landward forces of South Africa, the last pieces of equipment that it bought were 30, 40 years ago, because, again, South African state does not perceive itself to be threatened by other states, which is what I think was discussed yesterday. Again, the control of the border, one of the South Africa has been pressurized by countries like the United Kingdom to control its borders more because of the movement of Al-Qaeda via South Africa to the United Kingdom, as I explained there. So in terms of the South African government, it does not see itself as threatened. Even on the economic front, it does not see the South African economy as requiring its own inputs in terms of the international relations. It sees the South African economy as essentially owned by the white population rather than by the state as such, or the people of South Africa. And it sees it as owned by multinationals. So, again, there are no efforts to defend the economic assets of South African citizens from, for example, being seized in Zimbabwe, which is what has been happening over the last 10 or 11 years. What is interesting is that the South African government, in fact, precisely because it doesn't see the seizure of these assets as being damaging to the national interest, has been rewarding the Zimbabwe regime. Recently, the South African government gave 300 million rands to the Mugabe regime, allegedly for agricultural development, which is a bit of a mystery to us, how you achieve agricultural development under the circumstances that you have in Zimbabwe. So, which brings us to the point which I raised initially about how states, when they claim to be promoting democracy, actually have hidden agendas. The South African government is a classic illustration of these hidden agendas. The hidden agenda, or not so hidden agenda, of the South African government vis-a-vis Zimbabwe, is that the ZANU-PF Mugabe regime has a common threat to its power that the South African ANC government sits with. In Southern Africa, Southern Africa being a very industrialized part of sub-Saharan Africa or of Africa generally, we have a large trade union movement. If you look at the mineral belt in Africa, the metals mining belt starts from the Democratic Republic of Congo and stretches all the way to South Africa, Namibia, Angola, and so on. And because of this, we have very strong trade unions in Southern Africa. And the trade unions have decided to start opposing the traditional nationalist movements by setting up political parties. The first one to do this was in Zambia, which won an election against President Kaunda, who was the liberator, or the father of Zimbabwe, of Zambia, as they like to be called. The second party country where the trade unions formed a political party is Zimbabwe, with the Movement for Democratic Change. And this movement, within 6 months of it being formed, won an open election against ZANU-PF in February 2000. Since then, elections have been rigged in Zimbabwe, which is why it has not been winning. But essentially, it has been winning elections since 2000. In South Africa, the ANC sees the biggest threat to its power as coming from the trade unions again and other civil society organizations, which is why it is buttressing the ZANU-PF regime with donations like the 300 million rands that I indicated. So what is it that one can say about promotion of democracy? South Africa is definitely not promoting democracy in Zimbabwe, although it says it is promoting democracy. If anything, it's buttressing the power of the ZANU-PF regime. So can we generalize about, in conclusion, Madam Chair, can we generalize about whether South Africa promotes or doesn't promote democracy? I think one can't generalize in that respect, which is why I was saying, from my point of view, I would rather states did not get involved in trying to proselytize. South Africa actually does two things. It supports anti-democracy in the case of Zimbabwe because it does not want the trade union movement to become the base for new type political parties. But in other countries like Burundi, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and so on, it does play quite positive roles in creating or in facilitating, let me put it that way, for example, negotiations between the parties in the DRC and in Burundi, and in helping in the democratic process. So I think my conclusion really is taking me back to what I said at the beginning. I think the states promoting democracy, in my view, is a recipe for disaster, which is not to say civil society institutions, organizations, and so on should not support other civil society that are struggling for democracy, like we saw in our own country, South Africa, with the support we got from other civil societies throughout the world to oppose the apartheid system. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mweletsi. Let me hand it straight over to Pauline to respond.
Thank you. This is actually a very difficult case study in many respects. First of all, South Africa, compared to the other case studies in this project, is the newest, you might say,